You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, yeah. All the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
This is Jason Miller, author of Second Skin, Tales and Truths from the Mosh Pit of Life, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And to make sure you never miss an episode, you have a few options. The best way is to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, or go to marketingbookpodcast.com and sign up for email notifications. Or if you're on LinkedIn, find the Marketing Book Podcast page and click the subscribe button and maybe meet some of your fellow listeners. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Jason Miller to talk about his book, Second Skin, Tales and Truths from the Mosh Pit of Life, published by Heavy Metal Thunder. Jason Miller is a digital B2B marketer who has held senior marketing roles at LinkedIn, Marketo, and ActiveCampaign. Before entering the B2B space, he spent 10 years at Sony Music developing and executing marketing campaigns around the biggest names in music. He is a popular and very different keynote speaker, digital marketing instructor at the University of California, Berkeley, and best-selling author of Welcome to the Funnel, Proven Tactics to Turn Your Social Media and Content Marketing Up to 11, which was featured on episode 28 of the Marketing Book Podcast in 2015. Also, an accomplished rock photographer, Jason photographs the world's biggest rock stars on stages across Europe and the U.S. He's shot more than 1 million photos, interviewed thousands of musicians, documented and published his work in the limited edition book Down in Front. His photos have been featured in Vive La Rock magazine and on album covers of diverse artists from Warrior Soul to the comeback album of pop princess Tiffany. And, interesting fact, he is not the Jason Miller who is the author of Sex, Sorcery, and Spirit, The Secrets of Erotic Magic. Jason, congratulations on Second Skin, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome back, friend. I knew this day would come.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you for that warm intro. Yes, it's been a wild ride.
Yes, and there's only one person that doesn't need this question asked, which is Jason Miller. Are you ready to rock?
I am 1,000% ready to rock. I'm always ready to rock. It's always turned up to 11.
That's the only question people don't need to ask Jason Miller. So one thing that was not in your bio that I just shared is that you were a bass player in a variety of hair metal bands, and you wore zebra-striped spandex pants. So, Jason Miller, be honest, as we record this, I can't see you. Are you wearing zebra-striped spandex pants right now?
No. No, I am not, but I still have them. And when I go on the Monsters of Rock cruise, usually every year, they do make an appearance. So I still have them. They don't look as good on me as they did when I was 17, but, you know, I'm in that mode where I just don't really care anymore. I kind of do what I want to do.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yeah.
Wise words.
Yeah, so at this rate, you will have officially been on the Marketing Book Podcast every 447 episodes. But I think that we can improve that average because you have an updated version of Welcome to the Funnel and another book coming out about personal branding, Alive and Amplified. Yes.
I've got several. I've got three coming out. We have a near 10th anniversary of Welcome to the Funnel. There's so much to update there, but the core of the book still rings true, I think. There's a the sequel to Second Skin, which has been in the works simultaneously, called Alive and Amplified, and then a third follow-up to my concert photography book. It's simply called Bangers. And it comes out this Christmas. Black and white photos from the underground scene of London. So, yeah.
Excellent. And you teased the reader on Second Skin by including a number of your photographs. Just amazing. And I'd seen a number of them on your website, Rock and Roll Cocktail, in the past. But I do have to share that my favorite one, your favorite picture in this book, page 98, and that's the picture at Royal Albert Hall with you, your lovely wife, Tricia, and your children, Jackson and Penny.
Yes. And I tell you what, like, sometimes I pinch myself and I think I'm in Royal Albert Hall, just being in the venue. But I mean, I've shot some bands there. We go to the Christmas concert there. This, what a magical, magical place. I mean, like I get to take a step back and say, like, I live in London, which blows my mind. And the fact that I get these experiences with my family, it's incredible to me. It really is.
Oh gosh. And I should also mention for, Marketing Book Podcast listeners who are playing the home game, you also made a special guest appearance on the limited time series Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails, and I will include a link to that as well as your earlier episode on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And you know what? There's a few other books that I'm sure you've read that have been on the show that intersect with rock music and marketing, and I'm going to include links to those interviews at this episode's website page, also at marketingbookpodcast.com. So the book has been endorsed by a number of heavy hitters like Ann Handley, Doug Kessler, Laura Gassner Auding, John Burkhart, and Mark Masters, to name a few. And Doug Kessler, who is one of my favorite writers, he's with Velocity Partners in London, and another American living in London like you. And I should add, Doug, like Andy Bernard on The Office, is a Cornell graduate. But I just want to quote from what he said. Only a story like this could create the bizarre combination of leather, weed, B2B marketing, and death metal that is Jason Miller. I couldn't stop reading. Neither could I. Next thing I knew, I was missing NFL games because I started reading this in the morning and it was like, no, wait, I want to find out what happens next. And then Mark Masters, with You Are the Media, who lives down in Bournemouth, England. Big Bournemouth fan. Go Bournemouth. And he's also the author of Content Revolution. He's a past Marketing Book Podcast guest. And, interesting fact, he was the very first British author I interviewed. And I think the only one that actually drank beer while he was being interviewed. But, I mean, it was the cocktail hour in England, so that's fine. He wrote, "Here's a story about the importance of reinvention and the crossroads we all face. Jason shows us that when we find ways to shed our skin, we create opportunities, learn new skills, catapult our efforts, and make a meaningful impact in the ever-changing landscape of possibility. As our hero says, do you always." So, Jason, years ago, I'm a fan of a number of the bands you mentioned in your book, but also REM. And I remember years ago, REM had yet another album come out. And for the promotional tour, the lead singer, Michael Stipe, did not participate. And instead, it was just Peter Buck and Mike Mills, the lead guitarist and the bass player, who went on, did the tours and were on all the news channels and so forth. And they said, "Well, wait, where's Michael Stipe? Where's Michael Stipe?" And these guys explained that what normally happened in these interviews is that the journalists would maybe ask a question or two about the songs or how they, you know, where they recorded it, how they did it. And then they would very quickly jump into the soul of Michael Stipe and start asking him the most personal, piercing questions, which, you know, good on Michael Stipe to put up with that for so long. I could never do that. So they said, you know, he's just going to sit this one out. And so I don't want that to happen to you. I don't want to jump too far into your soul, although you bared it in your book. But I'm going to read a couple of excerpts from the book and then ask you to talk about your, you know, your foundations from growing up to getting your first job to where you are now at the top of the B2B marketing world to where you are, which is maybe the first third of the book or so. And then in the remaining time, I want to ask you a series of questions that I think would be really, really helpful for marketers from the standpoint of, you know, marketing their organizations, but also marketing themselves, which of course goes right into that other book you're working from. So, but I don't want to go into it too much, but I do want you to set the stage. And I want to start by reading the introduction. You write, quote, "by being rock and roll." That's the short answer to the question, how does a teenage metalhead from a dysfunctional home in Missouri's boondocks get here? Where's here exactly? Well, I've been called a B2B marketing expert, sought-after speaker, award-winning concert photographer, best-selling author, to which I insist on adding 80s metal karaoke idol and Seinfeld trivia sage. Yet I've done a lot, been through a lot, seen a lot, drank a lot, smoked a lot, good and bad and ugly. This is my bismore. Like a memoir, but it's bismore, to borrow the term coined by my twisted sister friend, J.J. French. These pages recount my personal and professional journey, served up with a few marketing insights, because any professional success I've had is rooted in life experience. In my 40-something years, I've realized that who we are, what we do, and what we learn are inextricably linked. If we apply what we learn, we grow. If we don't, we stagnate. Like it or not, life only marches forward. Our choices are lead the pack, follow the pack, or choke in its dust. My instinct is to keep pushing boundaries and shedding the old. This is why I've called my book Second Skin. But I remain true to myself simply because I don't know how to be anyone else. And then I want to jump all the way to the end of the book, to pages 96 and 97, and towards the end of the book, you were talking about Trisha and your relationship and your family, and you write that one time she commented that I was a broken man, and I agree. Who wouldn't be after all that shit I've been through since childhood? And then on the next page, you write, I still pinch myself when I think back on how I got here, from the chaos of my adolescence to the collapse of the music industry. Sometimes I feel like my life began at the age of 36, and that I had some serious catching up to do. But the reality is that I am the product of everything I've been through, and not just what I consider the good bits. So, Jason, now, take us back, if you would, take as long as you need, and lay the foundation that I've just touched on there, you know, your childhood, your early career in the music industry, and your transition to the top of B2B marketing.
Yeah, so I think without going too far back and taking away from the beginning of the story, you know, I think if we jump into what, you know, I was just I think metal, having metal, one of the central themes of the book is you know, having something to help you through the hard times when there's no one else there. And for me, that was always heavy metal, and it became this central theme. And, you know, to be honest with you, and I talk about this in the book, I had trouble fitting in high school. I didn't know I could. I wasn't a jock. I tried to play sports. I sucked at them. I wasn't smart enough to be, you know, a nerd. I guess we're all, I'm kind of a heavy metal nerd. I wasn't smart enough to be in chess club or anything. But there was this little group of heavy metal kids, and they'd take anybody. They'd take all sort of the misfits, if you will. So it kind of fell into it, I think, much like most of us fall into B2B marketing, I would imagine. But, you know, and that sort of paved the way for this rebellious sort of nature and sort of fighting back and pushing, and always trying to get caught up and trying to, you know, push myself even further to see just to see what's possible. You know, someone asked me the other day. They said, "What drives you and who are you trying to impress?" And I thought to myself, well, "No one. I just want to see if I can do it." You know, and I think that's the running theme of my life is, can I do it? And that's, you know, reinvention. It's moving from I was in a hair metal band, as you mentioned. We signed an independent record deal when I was, you know, 17, I think. Long hair. You know, we had, you know, I don't want to say group. We had girls that you know, put on our makeup for us and everything, and we were living the dream. And then
I should add that in the book you made very clear that it's not eyeliner, it's guyliner.
Guyliner, that is exactly right.
And so I've been wearing eyeliner ever since I read that, and I'm feeling okay about it.
We had such a good time. I tell you, I had super long hair. I won best hair in high school because my mother was a hairdresser. She had a beauty shop in our basement when I was growing up, and she said, if you're going to have long hair, damn it, it's going to be beautiful. And so I won. I beat out all the girls in school in my yearbook. So
I'll be honest, it was good looking hair, you know.
But you know, the problem was is that we were having such a good time playing just silly, you know, heavy rock, hair metal, whatever, like Poison and, you know, Motley Crue stuff. But we were all sitting around one night watching Headbangers Ball, and I remember Ricky Rackman came on, and he said, oh, that was Motley Crue with Skull Crusher of the Week. He goes, up next, we got a brand new band. We think you're really going to enjoy them. And he goes, they're called Nirvana. And we're like, oh, my God, we saw this video for Smells Like Teen Spirit. And, like, literally a week later, the entire genre of hair metal was completely wiped off the map. It was impressive.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And do you still hold that against Dave Grohl?
You know, Dave is one of the last rock warriors and the champion. He's everyone's hero in rock and roll. So, no. But I am glad to see that hair metal had a resurgence, and it's still, you know, it's kind of the cool thing now, but back then it was not. But yeah, anyway, but that, I mean, that's just one of the moments of reinvention, right? So reinventing from hair metal into something meaningful in this new direction. You know, I eventually figured that, you know, the music, I wasn't going to make it in a band. God, it was crazy to think, I guess I would. So I went to work in the music industry and live vicariously through the artists I work with. But also, I love turning people on to new music. I still do. And I thought that was, you know, that was my goal. And so I put everything I had into it, and I pushed and pushed and pushed, got a job at Sony. It's all the stories are in the book. And then I watched that industry that I love so much, you know, fight digital instead of embracing it and try
well,
to
now,
keep
well, let's hold up for a second there. You were in, I guess, St. Louis at that point. And what was it you were doing for Sony? Because people need to understand this is before we had any kind of streaming.
Yeah. So I was what they call a college marketing rep. So I was going to school during the day, and then at night, and I would run around to record stores and hang up posters and go to college radio stations and try to get them to, you know, try to get them to play our new artists so they would rank on the CMJ, the College Music Journal charts. And then I would go out to a show, and, you know, I was the only rep in town. So we, you know, I had to drive the band to the hotel and drive the band to the radio station. We do the meet and greets, and then we go out and we take them out afterwards. So for a kid in college who loves music, I mean, there wasn't a better job for me. And this is 98, 99. So this is the dawn. I was out with System of a Down, you know, when no one knew who they were, on a van. Mudvayne. We were out with Slayer when they were kind of having their comeback, and Incubus when they first started, Korn when they first started. So all these bands that, you know, that became these, that reinvented metal pretty much. I was with them, and I got to see this, and
including Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, and the record company said, "Whatever you do, don't take him to a strip club."
That there was this thing, like, you know, in St. Louis, there's not a lot to do in St. Louis, right? So in East St. Louis, just across the river from downtown, there's no liquor laws in East St. Louis in Illinois. So there's a little oasis called Sauget, Illinois, and it's two strip clubs and a club that's open 24 hours a day. And it's literally, you know, you can go over there and stay there all, like, I remember in college, they closed from 6 to 6:30, just to sweep out the floor.
In the morning?
We wait outside. Yeah, in the morning. We wait outside and go back in. So, yeah, that's what you did.
Well, they wanted you to get some fresh air, I suppose.
Yeah, but and the Tom Morello story is funny because he was, this is when Rage was, you know, at their peak of their powers pretty much. And
causing trouble for the BBC, as I recall.
What's that?
Causing trouble for the BBC, as I recall.
Yes, exactly. they were very political, and they were very driven. So I will say that. But the nicest guys you'd ever want to meet. And Tom was, I guess he had family in Chicago, and he was driving this Porsche back to LA, and it broke down in St. Louis. And this whole story's in the book. And I got a call out of the blue. Said, "Jason, this is Tom Rowe," and I was rushing to get to another gig that night, and I thought it was my roommate, like, messing with me, so I told him to F off, and I hung up on him. And then 5 minutes later, Epic Records calls me and says, hey, Jason, Tom Morello's car broke down. He might be calling you. And I'm like, this is like a part of a movie. This really happened. Like, I can't make this up. And then I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I think he just called. And so he did call back. And I mean, like, you've seen this like play out in 100 movies, but this really happened. It was before all those movies. And he said, this is really Tom Morello. And I said, so Tom, I'm so sorry. Anyway, we went and picked him up at a block in front of a Blockbuster video or something. He was waiting there. And then we took him out. And then we had a great time at the store. I don't remember the story. It's all in the book. But then the next day, I think we got in at like 4 a.m. And we got in the next day. Like it was Saturday. And we slept it. We took him to see Dick Dale, funny enough. I remember we woke up probably like 2 p.m. in the afternoon, me and my roommate Chris. And he called again. He said, my car's not ready. You want to go out again? I'm like, yeah, I mean, what do you say? Sure. And we had just the best time ever. He's such a cool guy. And he's so good to the fans. I mean, one of the best people I've ever met, I think, industry or not.
Yeah. And those performers are also some of the hardest working people. People don't always realize how hard they have to work and how much goes on behind the scenes. So you started to touch on this, but let's get into how inertia and short-sightedness started to sink the music industry, because there was a lot of frustration you started to have with the music industry and your employers, and it started to remind me of David Meerman Scott, where he worked in the news industry, and he was being told how to market these organizations, and he said, no, let's do it this way. And he ultimately got fired because they said, no, you got to do it the old way. And the rest is history. He then wrote a book on the new rules of marketing and PR. So talk about what was going on there, because it also reminded me of Kodak, where Kodak invented the digital camera, but they thought of themselves as being in the film and the chemical industry. And it's sometimes just too hard for an organization to make that transition.
Well, you know, it's what's interesting to me is that, you know, and I talk about this in the book, like, I think it could have been different. I mean, I was low man on the totem pole, like, at Sony for a very long time. But I was out in the field and I was with the artists and I sort of like saw a lot of things firsthand and I knew how they were feeling. There was some really, like, you know, when you have a band that you love and you see the potential and they tell you that their entire life's work is in this album and they get one shot. And if it doesn't work, then that just gets kind of tossed to the side and they move on to the next thing. So I think it was, you know, it was largely driven by radio. If you had a single and it didn't get on radio, even if it did get on radio, if it didn't get traction blow up right away, you're pretty much doomed. So I'd say 9 out of 10 bands just never even got a chance. I will say this though. Look, there's some super smart people, and some great people. I don't want to say it was all bad, but you know, when the major label machine worked, it worked incredibly well, and I think you see that through the superstar artists. You see it through, you know, Incubus, the ones that worked, Korn, System of a Down, Mudvayne, et cetera, John Mayer. But when it didn't work, you didn't hear about it. The bands just disappeared. And the book Second Skin came from the title of the Mayfield Four, their second album, which was on Epic and supposed to be it was a masterpiece, one of my favorite albums of all time, and it was supposed to be this big massive hit and breakthrough for the band, but it just, you know, it just fell on deaf ears, and a couple of shifts in management and, you know, across the label. And Miles Kennedy was the singer of the Mayfield Four, who's now very, you know, very successful singer-songwriter in his own right. Plays with Slash and the Conspirators, and has his own solo thing, and of course Alter Bridge and touring the world. So he made it out, but he almost didn't. But the thing that killed me the most was all this amazing, great music that never got heard, just because I felt like it was given up on too early because it only had one path. And then digital came in, and it just exploded everything in a really bad way because no one knew what to do with it.
Yeah, and you talk about how, I don't know if it was Sony, but Napster was talking to the music companies about maybe doing a partnership, and they just said they had nothing to do with it. They threw them out. Are those the reasons why you reflect on your time in the music business with melancholy, despite the parts you enjoyed?
Well, I was very fortunate to have a good 10-year run, and I had, you know, a great boss and still some friends. I mean, one of my old bosses is now the GM of Interscope Records. I mean, like, we just had dinner a couple of months ago here in London, and some of my other colleagues are doing very well, VPs of Universal and whatnot. So, but it was, it wasn't that, the problem I think that I have is that I wasn't able to really showcase what I could do because I was kind of stuck in the field and I was never in an office situation. But I also felt that I came out with a lot of good ideas that were really hard to sell in this new space because it was so new.
Yeah.
And it was, I think everyone was scrambling to try to figure things out. I mean, there's a story literally, like a friend of mine, and it's in the book as well, wanted me to bring in a new artist by Twitter in the old Twitter office. When there was like maybe, I think it was maybe 100 people working at Twitter, and it could have been the first band to ever play a live stream from Twitter, and I could not get anybody to let me bring the band by. The labels just kept passing on it, and these weren't people that I knew. These were labels like beyond my bosses and whatever. Like, so I just didn't, no one seemed to care, and it frustrated me, and I had to tell the guy at Twitter, which I knew was going to be the next big thing, that no, we can't bring the artist by. So someone else got it. One of the other labels finally figured it out. But
right, yeah, and then they probably felt like they wasted their time with you, and then they might not have thought of you first the next time. So let's go that last. Let's connect that last dot. Talk about as Sony was kind of consolidating and dropping people, they would move you around to different cities, and at one point they move you to San Francisco. Talk about how you finally made the leap from the music industry to marketing.
So yeah, I mean, 10 years in marketing, and I felt like I hadn't learned anything. And you know, I mean, it just kept getting worse. They kept, you know, the CDs were declining in sales. Streaming wasn't really a thing yet. They didn't have a model. You know, iTunes was the only avenue of selling singles for 99 cents, and you know, there's no money to be made there. So yeah, I kept getting calls saying like your job's been eliminated. But like again, I had a good boss and they believed in me. But they just that wasn't enough. So I got I got a call from Austin and they eliminated my job there. I moved to Houston. Then my job got eliminated in Houston. Then I moved to Dallas. Then I got eliminated in Dallas. Then I moved to San Francisco. But they moved me to San Francisco so I could be closer to the digital space, right? So you know, iTunes was out there, Apple, Google. But I just could not make the transition, not out of not because of effort, lack of effort on my part, but due to just some of the gatekeepers in it.
Right, within the business, they just didn't accept you. Yeah,
and that really, I don't know if they thought because I was this retail guy that maybe I didn't understand digital, but you know, I took all these digital courses because Sony had a reimbursement program, which a lot of people didn't know about. And so I was taking these accelerated digital PPC courses and research, and I got 3 certificates in a year and a half. And I mean, it's one of the classes that I teach at UC Berkeley now, which is ironic. But you know, I felt that, you know, that it was up to me to get these skills while I could, and then I had to figure out a way to get out because it wasn't ever going to transition.
Mm-hmm. So they were actually paying for you to learn what you could do at your next job, which I thought that was somewhat ironic.
Yeah, and true story, ironically, right when I finished these courses, I was doing a lot of digital ad strategy and PPC stuff with Google, and the international team asked me to help them out with some stuff. And then after I quit, someone called me and asked me if I could do some consulting for them. And I thought, I used to work for you, like, and I tried. And you know, and there's another thing in the book where I literally put together this whole like 6-page plan for a blog at Sony. This is before blogs were a thing. I ran into one of the guys I worked with years ago at South by Southwest. I said, "Hey, whatever happened to that plan I sent over for the Columbia Records blog?" And he goes, "What plan? What are you talking about?" I'm like, "Oh Jesus!" I'm like, "I'm so glad I'm talking out of this."
That's right. You talked about be the media instead of relying on, like, let's say Rolling Stone to get the word out.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, again, there's it's just so much confusion and nobody really knew. Digital just came up so quick and with Napster and the value of music, the perception of the value of music dropping so quickly. And again, it's the classic tale of what happens when you try to fight disruption.
Yes,
we all know what happens now.
Yes, and I can understand why people think the way they do. And you know, a lot of what you're saying really is an observation, probably more than a criticism. So you ultimately left and you started working in the tech industry. And as I mentioned earlier, you worked at LinkedIn. You worked ultimately at ActiveCampaign, Marketo, a few other companies. Now, I said from the music industry to marketing. Well, in truth, you were in marketing for 10 years. But on one page, like at page 91, you say, "My entry into professional marketing was an abrupt gear shift from everything I had done before." And I want to quote from page 57, which shows enormous humility on your part. And I think it will encourage a lot of people listening who are new to marketing or are overwhelmed by it. You said, "I didn't know what I was doing when I began working in digital marketing." Does that surprise people?
I remember, like, this is a true story. Like, I when I left Sony and went over to my first job, I got my foot in the door at a little startup called Zoomering, Market Tools. Zoomering was the product. It was a survey tool. And I got my and the only reason I got that job is because I started my own blog. I started Rock and Roll Cocktail, and I just started writing about things I was learning about. This is a classic scenario. This is how I built my reputation at Marketo. You have a problem. You find an expert, interview them, and you write about it. And I did that in my own time on my own blog, and that got me in the door, even though I didn't have any digital experience per se. But yeah, and this is a true story. I remember there was a guy I was working with, and he said, he goes, "Hey, we have this email campaign going out, and you can click on this, and you can download a PDF ebook." I said, "You can download a PDF ebook? Are you kidding me? This is the coolest thing I've ever seen." That was how naive I was. But you know, I had no idea what I was doing, so that just meant I had to work twice as hard. But I'll tell you what, like that's what drives me is the things I don't know, but the opportunity was there to smash it, and that's kind of what I do. And I will tell you this, even to this day, every time I start a new job or a new project, every time I think to myself, I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Oh, that's such great advice for everyone. And I just want to add to that. There's two things. One from page 8, you talk about stagnation. And you say it's one of your most hated things where it remains to this day. It fuels your desire to be in the vanguard. It's an obsession, which is what's required to keep up in digital marketing, where change is relentless. Some burn out or become complacent. But for me, that's a fuck yeah, let's go. And then on 18, you write that you've always had an obsessive drive to learn everything about the things that interest you, which is just, it's great. I mean, you know, sometimes, you know, you're always talking to college students or you know, younger people, the kids these days, as I like to say. And I think some flawed advice is to follow your passion. But I think that the more that you can find something that interests you, you always do better. And you really zeroed in on the things that interest you, and it's done really, really well. So I want to talk about something else about Jason Miller that I think is helped me enormously and very valuable. You write that you have built friendships that continue to this day by being truthful rather than telling people what they want to hear. And if you could talk more about that, because I think there's a lot more fear in the business world than people will acknowledge. And I think there's a lot of people that are just afraid of speaking the truth to clients or to their chain of command.
You know, it's and even in the music business, and it kind of parlayed into B2B, I was such a fan of some of these bands that I was honest with them. I was really honest whether or not I thought their song was going to break or whether or not this sounded as good. Like and maybe I was talking to someone who put their life's work into that, but I was doing it in a manner of like I was just trying as a passionate fan trying to give direct feedback. Some people really appreciated that, and some folks some didn't so much. And those stories are in the book. But I think when I went to LinkedIn, you know, I learned so much at LinkedIn in the early days when no one, you know, gave a shit about LinkedIn and the, you know, before it blew up to what it is today.
And even LinkedIn didn't quite know what you guys were doing, right?
We had no idea. Like, we had no idea. Like, we had a very small marketing team. We didn't even have a paid product per se. They launched sponsored updates the week that I joined. That's how early on it was. No one knew there was even a marketing opportunity on LinkedIn.
So they kind of you kind of had some free reign there.
Well, we did. It was because no one cared about it because they didn't they didn't really see the future. So like, but everyone, you know, everyone thinks that, oh, you worked at LinkedIn, you had this big budget. Like, no, we didn't. We had
this was before Microsoft bought them, right?
Oh, way before, yeah. And everyone thought, oh, LinkedIn's got millions of followers. Not LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. Yeah, we're the same company, but they didn't. They never shared us. They never helped any of us. They never helped us share any of our content or messaging. They were afraid it was going to dilute their audience. And you know, yeah, we had free reign. But the, you know, the important thing was we had the one of the cultural pieces of LinkedIn, which I still carry with me, is how to deliver feedback, and that piece was open, honest, and constructive. And I think if you know, it's that rule of threes. If you can take that approach with every I guess every opportunity you have to provide feedback to somebody or one on ones with your team or whatnot, I think they appreciate that. And you know, I think what you're seeing right now is a lot of charlatans. I call them on LinkedIn, which are, you know, oh, especially with the AI stuff.
Yes.
Oh, I closed 147 deals this month with my AI system. It's like, but yeah, you're talking B2B marketers. Let's talk about what's your average deal size? What's your product? What's your buying cycle? You really want to go there? But I see they're telling people what they want to hear.
Yeah.
And I see it like going viral, and it drives me crazy. So yeah, I try to go the opposite and just say, look, This is what it's really like, and this is coming from someone who's done this, you know, in the trenches of B2B marketing. I wouldn't feel comfortable telling you this unless I either failed at it or I found a way to solve the challenge. You know?
Yeah, I remember early in my advertising agency career, a boss told me the advice of when you're talking to a client, always try to discern the difference between what they want and what they need. And the other thing that I think is interesting from what you're talking about there is that you were a fan, sure, but you were also a marketer with a deep understanding of the customer. And that is one of the biggest flaws of a lot of companies these days is they just don't understand their customers as well as they want to or they think they do. And it's very difficult. But the ones that do have an understanding of their customers always seem to work well. And they don't have to have it perfectly. They just have to be a little bit better than their competition. Oh,
yeah,
so,
I agree.
Yeah, so the other thing I want to ask you about, and we kind of started to touch on this without maybe folks realizing it, but you mentioned your blog, okay? And this is from page 51, and I think this is very valuable, you know, long-term career advice. You write, when your company no longer seems to know what to do with you, and I hear from a lot of marketers who complain about that. When your company no longer seems to know what to do with you, and when you no longer feel challenged, walk away. I've had to do that a few times, and it's quite empowering. If you have a strong network to fall back on, you should never fear quitting a job. Now, what that brought to mind for me, you know, everyone reads something and interprets it differently. You know Michael Brenner very well. And he's been on the show a couple times. And I remember when he was working for SAP, he was doing a blog, and it was called, I think it was B2B Marketing Insider.
Yeah.
And he was basically writing what he was learning as he was trying to get that big organization to transform into more of a content marketing organization. And it was really, really interesting. And he was, you know, really trying to swim upstream, but he was very successful. And while he was still there, I remember thinking, you know, that guy has such a following and such a network that he's never going to have to look for a job in the future because he was so well known. And ultimately, he left SAP on good terms, but he's gone on to other jobs and now he's got his own business. And I was wondering if you could talk about how powerful that has been for you, like with your blog, as well as the network to fall back on.
Well, I think it's, you know, I love Michael. He's such a good guy, and he's so smart. And again, he was one of the influencers like on my list when I started at Markel. Like, I got to meet this guy. I want a guest blog for him. He's so brilliant. And we spent many nights at Content Marketing World, you know, in the pubs and whatnot. But the lesson there, again, it's really nothing new outside of, you know, the old quote, you know, don't hate the media, become the media. If you can't get traction of people talking about you or building, or, you know, your audience, like, you know, you got to find your tribe, and you find your tribe by finding like the challenges, like people who have similar challenges to you, and you solve them in a unique, creative way. And then you share how you did it. And if you do it well and you do it consistently, then you know, you're going to build an audience no matter what. And the more niche you can get, I think the more, I think the better, you know, it becomes trying to, when you can find that underserved audience. And for Michael Brenner, the B2B audience with real opinions and real experience at that time, it couldn't have been a better fit, right? So
it was so helpful.
And I think it's you know, do you have something to say? Of course, everyone has something to say. But getting the confidence out there and getting the channel, you know, to do so is it's up to you. You know, Liam Gallagher said, "You can have it all, but how bad do you want it?"
Yes, and I think, great quote.
How much can you push yourself?
Yeah. You mentioned Chris earlier. Tell us who Chris Buehler is.
So Chris is my—he's my best friend in the world. He was the best man at my wedding. We were college roommates together. He wrote the foreword to the book, and he was working at—we lived together in college. He was the Interscope college rep, and I was the Sony college rep. So we had very similar jobs, and so every single night we were out with a band or at a show or doing something crazy every single night. When I got the job at Sony and moved to Austin, he started his own agency. And long story short, when I transitioned into the B2B space and I went to Marketo, Chris had this, you know, this B2C agency, and I called him up and I said, "Hey man, do you ever work on a B2B campaign?" He goes, "No, what's that?" I'm like, "Fantastic!" And we brought him on board. So we had this B2C approach in a B2B world, and at the time, no one had seen anything like that before. And so the rest of and he was my agency all the way through Marketo. I brought him into LinkedIn. We did the Sophisticated Marketer, everything Sophisticated Marketers series there, won a bunch of awards. We did the first podcast at LinkedIn, did the first live stream at LinkedIn, lots of firsts. And now Chris has this massive agency. And he's a LinkedIn certified partner. They won the best partner award last year. But you know, again, it goes back to my tribe and my pit crew and you know, having those relationships. And I couldn't have done it without Chris. We feed off each other, and he couldn't do it without me.
You quote him in the book on page 53, and I'd like you to expand on this further if you can. He said, "Jason and I have been able to bring to marketing the vibe of in-store meet and greets where you get people to come in and listen to a band. That's where the magic starts. We don't approach B2B campaigns with a business mentality. We approach them with a, how do we make something really cool so people will actually give a shit about it attitude? It's really that simple."
Yeah, and it was about, you know, how do we entertain? How do we make something entertaining that positions the brand in a place where it's approachable, and that people want to be a little bit closer to it because they think it's cool. And I think, you know, back then no one was thinking about B2B like that. It was all sales cycles and this and that. And there were people who said, "Oh, you can't have, you know, a personality in B2B," like, which is insane to think about that now, because it's the exact opposite. Now, I'm not saying we, you know, the people who invented this, not by any means, but I think we brought it to a space and made a lot of noise, and made it acceptable to, you know, to do really cool, fun, experimental leaps of faith in the B2B marketing space around 2012, 2013. So yeah. I'm really proud of that.
Well, I think there was a lot of leadership there, which I want to talk about in a minute. But speaking of entertaining, you've got a chapter about your, you know, your approach to keynotes. And again, it was sort of the thing where you didn't really know much about it, but you said, "All right, well, what do I got to do?" And you did have a lot of experience on stage, except it was playing a bass and having really, really good hair. But there's a section on page 61, and I couldn't agree with it more. And you write, many of the people who attend conferences are seeking new approaches to marketing their business's brand or product. I do my best to present the hows and whys of successful marketing, making sure to convey that they can do this too. Frequently, speakers use examples from Nike, Red Bull, Volvo, Dove, etc., million-dollar campaigns with 50 people driving them, to inspire startups with zero budgets or resources. How does that help anyone? Why do you think that happens so often? Is it because people think, oh, more people will know about it if I use them as an example?
I think because it's easy. I think it's easy, and it's easy to relate to very quickly, right? So, I mean, what I found, again, like back in the day, this is a true story. There was a digital conference in San Francisco right when Old Spice, I think, did the man that your man could smell like or something.
Yeah.
And it completely went viral and crazy. And I don't remember the person's name who did the campaign, but they were speaking about the campaign and how, and they were very proud of themselves. I do remember that. And it was a brilliant campaign. I'm not taking anything away from that. But I remember that someone in the audience came, they said, are there any questions? And somebody in the audience said, because they were really, you know, blowing themselves up like, oh yeah, it was super easy, we came up with this. And someone asked them a question. They said, if it's so easy, why haven't you done it again? And the guy, the person got really pissed off and walked off stage. But you know, it's again, like, I think you see the same examples because they're easy. Red Bull,
yeah.
Like the other day, someone posted a carousel like, "Oh, brands you need to be like." It's like, are you kidding me? The best, coolest brands are the tiny little businesses who don't give a shit, who are having fun with their messaging and really doing the surprise and delight and having personality and poking fun and, you know, I just they're just harder to find.
Like Marcus Sheridan's pool company.
Yeah, exactly. It's a classic example. But you know, even there's a sock company here in London called the London Sock Company, and I love socks. I think all marketers love socks for some reason. And they put this. They had an email go out, and they said that they would donate two pairs of socks for every pair purchased in December to a charity. And they messed up the copy, and it said 22 pairs of socks. And they came back and said, you know what? We're going to go ahead and honor that anyway. And I thought that was like, it's just really funny. So they took a hit on it. But like these, yeah, they had the fun and personality. And I just ordered some stickers for my blog. And I found this little sticker company I never heard of before. Most delightful, fun experience. Like, I feel like I'm close. I feel like they're my friend. And you know, these are the examples that you don't see because they're so infrequent. And they only happen to a small segment. So they're harder to find, hence it's more difficult for a marketer to pull it into a story.
Yes. I believe it or not, a couple years ago, I got a book. I get a lot of books now, folks interested in being interviewed. And this was one book where they profiled like five companies and what they're doing right. And I can't remember the exact ones, but it was like Nike, Google, Amazon. It was all the usual, Airbnb, all the usual suspects. And it was like, no! I don't need those examples anymore. So I touched earlier about on thought leadership, and I just wanted to talk about that thought leadership. It's one of those terms that's very important in marketing, and it is, I think, very, very misunderstood. And actually, there was a book on thought leadership by Bob Boudet that was on a while back. I'll include a link to that interview that I think people should listen to. And you write that thought leadership, which I think is very misunderstood, it means transforming an existing idea into something completely new, like Jimi Hendrix did with the Star Spangled Banner. Explain what you mean.
So, yeah, and I, you know, the Star Spangled Banner is a great example, but he took something that was familiar and he put his own spin on it and pushed it into territory that no one had ever even imagined before. And you could another example is Black Sabbath. They invented heavy metal. They took blues. They put their own spin on it, and they turned it into something that no one had ever heard of before. And I mean, I use a lot of music references, but I think, you know, if I think about thought leadership today, I certainly think the world has enough thought leaders, right? But not enough thought leadership, I would say. And now I think it's more important to have these strong opinions. I think thought leadership is around strong opinions, pushing these ideas forward, and trying to give people some sort of inspiration or hope to solve these challenges in new creative ways. And it sort of also ties into, you know, I talk a lot about creativity and creativity in marketing, which always sort of falls by default into the, oh, well, I'm not creative enough, or creative is only for artists and musicians. And this creativity isn't necessarily a specific skill that's related or, you know, related to a specific task, but it is certainly a skill, and it's something that can be learned.
Yes.
And it can be something that can be practiced. And so I think there was a new definition I saw of creativity, which I think I put in the book, which is not only you know, the art sort of definition, but a creativity in the sense of coming up with a new solution in a creative way, right? And I think that's something we can all sort of focus on, is not looking at creativity as an art or music, sort of how it's always been looked at in the past, but as a unique way of finding new solutions and brainstorming and spitballing and trying different approaches. And I think that's like sort of the critical piece there.
Yes, and there have been, I think, at least three really, really good books on the show about creativity, which talk about what you just mentioned. It's more of an approach. Connect, you know, it's like getting in shape. It's not some lightning in a jar you suddenly get. I'll include links to those on this page as well. But you just touched on something. I want you to say more and help folks understand. You say the world has enough thought leaders, but not enough thought leadership. Explain more about what you mean there.
Well, I think, you know, the fact that anyone can become a thought leader today, I think, you know, is both, you know, empowering.
Back also, to your LinkedIn newsfeed.
Yeah, also dangerous. And, you know, Doug Kessler, well, back to Doug Kessler. You know, when we did B2B Dinner for Five at LinkedIn years ago, tiny budget, by the way, scrapped it together, but we did had a lot of fun with that. You know, Doug said something that sticks with me to this day, and he said it was when all of the journal, all the different blogs and big journals were going away, and he said, you know, one day editorial jobs were from the big mass media companies were going away, and Doug said, he goes, you know what, one day we're going to miss the gatekeepers. Meaning that we're going to miss that quality control layer that is now, I think you're seeing run amok on LinkedIn. So anybody who has an AI prompt or can, you know, to drop a sales story into ChatGPT and make it AI related can go viral. And I think it buries the real quality stuff. And not to mention that many of the folks who are actually doing the best work are probably too busy doing the work to even share it on LinkedIn in many cases. So it's about finding the thought leaders who matter to you, who have the credibility, who have proven themselves, and who you know, who are relatable and who are actually doing work because they want to do it for themselves or they want to help others instead of going viral. I think that's kind of where I think about it now. And it's sad to me that that I think a lot of us compare ourselves every day to, if we don't post some piece on LinkedIn that gets 100 shares or 100 comments, that we're a failure. And again, it goes back to find your underserved audience, find your tribe. Solve some problems, share some ideas. Like that's always been about that, but now it's turned into a popularity contest.
Yeah. Well, just one thing about content. You write about the oversaturated market for content that's out there, and content shock, as Mark Schaefer calls it. And Mark Schaefer is the king of the Marketing Book Podcast.
I am your king.
He calls it content shock. That was one of his books. And you write that marketers sometimes freak out and they say something along the lines of, what's the point of investing in content if the value is declining? How are they missing the point with that attitude?
content's always going to be king, no matter what anybody says. It's a matter of, are you creating the right content? Are you creating the content that matters? And are you extracting as much value out of that content as you can? So I think there was, you know, lots of folks, we used to call it random acts of content, just pumping out content to go after different, you know, audiences and try to solve these problems. But I don't think there's ever been an argument in the need and the investment for content. But I think when you look at today on how we need to get a little bit better at solving people's problems quicker and inspiring them to show them that there is a solution and what you have to offer, that's what I think the focus can be. So it's kind of cutting through the fluff. I think years ago, I think there used to be a lot more room for fluff. Now I don't think there's room for any fluff. I think the fluff is being replaced by strong opinions and these creative approaches. But again, there should be no question about what content you create, how to create it. It's all out there. It's just a matter of how can you streamline it, be as helpful as possible, and have an opinion on why this is all critical and important. You know, and it goes back to one of the biggest problems I see all the time is there's a big stat that says, why you need to do this, or you know, why this is important, or jump on this trend. And one of the big things, I'll give you an example: brand marketing. Brand is the missing piece right now for pretty much all companies, specifically B2B. But you never get anyone who tells you concretely how to measure brand awareness, because it's hard. It's very hard, and you have to get very creative with the solution. Now, I have my own ways, and there are different ways, and you have to kind of, you know, figure these out for yourself. But there's an opportunity. There is an opportunity, much like thought leadership and the definition of what that meant years ago. There's opportunities out there to go out and crush it with owning that conversation and being specific and being strongly opinionated on it. And I think that's what's missing. So if you can nail those things, there should be no question about investing in content.
Yes, and speaking of the brand for B2B, this was covered, I think, in chapter 13. I sound like some savant. Chapter 13 of Louis Gadima's second edition of Bullseye Marketing. He talked, it was a new chapter, and he talked about why that's so important. And just because you can't measure it doesn't mean it's not important. One of my favorite lines, though, you started to touch on this. We can't just let that get away. Listen up, folks. Most random acts of content don't work well because they are inconsistent, irrelevant to the audience's concerns, and have neither an objective nor a key performance indicator attached.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Okay, just a couple other questions, and this is related to people, for career advice and advice for the young people out there.
By the way, I love the Warriors. I love the Warriors. One of my favorite movies of all time.
I had a feeling that was right up your wheelhouse.
100%.
So you talk about hybrid marketers and one-dimensional marketers. So explain what you mean when you say, you talk what a hybrid marketer is and what a one-dimensional marketer is, and which one makes you easily disposable.
Oh, this is really good timing, because I'll tell you what, we used to talk about this a lot at LinkedIn, and I had this idea, this hybrid marketer, and the hybrid marketer came from Marketo, and you know, when I was an employee like 105 or something at Marketo, and a very startup culture. It was my first time working in a startup like this, but I was sitting in between demand gen, product, PR, design, and you know, even though I was focused on content and social, I started to learn from the other folks around me, just because like you can't not learn from them and you can't not understand how these disciplines work together. So I thought that was really interesting, this approach where you don't have to be an expert in any one thing, but if you understand how they all work together, how all these different disciplines of marketing work together, then you're going to set yourself up for success, especially as you get more advanced into the leadership of marketing roles. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a lot of pushback, which is so ironic. I'm not saying I feel good about this by any means.
From the marketing world at large, you got the pushback?
Everyone was pushing back and saying, oh, you're spreading yourself too thin. It was like a jack of all trades, master of none, right? And I thought, what a bunch of horse shit. And now you're looking at AI. If you're a specialist, you're kind of doomed, because if you're a specialist in any one thing, especially if it has to do with data sets, you're doomed. So I don't want to say I told you so, but I just thought it was a better approach. Now, is there room for experts and specialists? Of course there is. There will always be. But I think if you want a long career in marketing and you aspire to be a VP of marketing or a leader, you have to understand, of course, how teams function and focus on team building and people. But you also have to know how these things fit together and what success looks like on a greater scale. That is what a lot of marketing leaders don't talk about because they just kind of do it. So I think that's what I meant. And I think the hybrid market is coming back around. And I think AI is forcing people, a lot of different people, to question whether or not they want to go deep in any one marketing discipline.
Yes, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Real quick story. I can remember back when I was a strapping young assistant account executive at the J. Walter Thompson New York ad agency. And it was around, I don't know, 1988 or so. And they had this massive print production department. And they even included two guys who were experts on typesetting. And they dealt with all the typesetting houses where you have a print ad and it would need to go out to a type house and they would set all the type. Okay. One day, both of those type guys were fired. And all the art directors were in an uproar and everyone was saying, how can you fire these type guys? What madness is this? And they said, well, there's a guy on the third floor now who has one of those computers, and he's going to do it. And sure enough, it was that's what happened. And all the art directors, they all threatened to quit and go on strike, which they never did. But it was sort of like, oh, all right. And all the type guys were gone. So if you're an expert in a particular area, just think about, could you suddenly become a type person? Or if you were an expert on Google Plus, all that could suddenly go away. So anyway, just on a personal note, I have to laugh, Jason Miller, when occasionally I'll get a pitch or maybe somebody on LinkedIn will message me, and they're like a 22-year-old agency growth consultant. And, I'm thinking, please, I'm just not sure how much experience you've had growing an agency. So on page 104, you wrote, ageism is a bitch in the workplace, in your hobby, in general. But in marketing, no 22-year-old growth hacker can hold a candle to a true marketing leader who's seen it all. Different organizational structures and team dynamics, firings, massive success and failure, economic downturns, even a pandemic, the one-trick ponies making your life hell by being difficult or judging you will be crushed when their one-dimensional approach is gobbled up by AI. And just when did digital creator become a legit job title? It's like claiming to be Jimi Hendrix because you aced Guitar Hero on Xbox. Oh, so you argue that senior marketers with substantial experience will continue to have the advantage. How so?
That sort of spawned off of two things. One was a dinner I was at, and there was a B2B marketer next to me, a brilliant B2B marketer who was having trouble because of that exact scenario. And they felt that they didn't have the skill set to compete with these new growth hackers. And I thought, and I was like, you've got it completely backwards. It's the other side around, the other way around. And the other piece came from watching, I think it was Infinity Wars, where Thanos is famously, getting ready to murder Thor, and Loki says, you might want to save me if you need a guide from Earth. And he says something to the effect of, if by God you mean failure, if someone who has experience in that realm, and he says, if by experience you mean failure, and he says, by experience I mean experience. And so that was the other piece, like experience is experience is experience. So all that experience, good and bad, is much more valuable than some growth hacking skills you can get, from a couple of viral posts. So, but the bigger picture was, yeah. What's left to do in marketing? This is my next post. What's left to do? Because apparently you can write 180, according to my LinkedIn feed today, someone wrote 187 blog posts in 7 minutes. And then they created 465 personalized videos in 3 minutes. And then there was another fearmonger who said, AI is coming for your job. What's left to do? You know what's left to do?
And I should add, all those guys were crypto experts 2 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And running with their NFTs. So, but what's left to do? What's really left to do? I will tell you this, in my honest opinion, strategy, leadership, and big ideas. That is the only thing left for marketing to do in the future once AI has its grips in. And the real sad thing is there's not going to be any where does a marketer cut their teeth? Where does a new marketer get all these experiences, because they're not going to be there to run through the motions anymore? And that's a shame. And I think you could say the same about like journalists. Where are the future journalists, prize-winning journalists, going to be coming from? Because all these local papers where they would learn the trade and cut their teeth and get the experience, they're all becoming obsolete. So I think, you know, the future of marketing is really, how do you get that experience? Harvard Business Review, an article came out just a month or so ago, said the half-life of skills is like 2 years now. So I'm not trying to be that fearmonger. I think that fearmonger pisses me off. What I'm saying is, and this is in the book, upskill. Push yourself. Continue to learn, and you'll be fine. You'll make it out alive, right? But
yeah,
it's all about upskilling, learning, and pushing yourself.
Yes, and listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. But I digress. Last thing I wanted to ask about was, again, for the young people out there, and this kind of touches on that. You write that marketers just entering the field will have to compete with AI to cut their teeth, and that's the biggest challenge they're going to face. So, again, your advice to the Gen Z and millennials who are listening.
Upskill, like I said before, learn as much as you can. Find the folks who inspire you, who are doing incredible work, who are doing it because they want to do it and because it's meaningful, not the ones who are doing it to be charlatans or go viral or try to teach you how to find a shortcut to engagement. Find your tribe. Find the people who inspire you. Join a community. Be part of that. Ask questions. Don't be afraid to try new things and put yourself out there. There's a million pieces of advice, but the biggest thing is continue to push yourself, continue to take chances, learn to be more creative, and find the people who inspire you and try to learn from them. My example was, you know, Anne Hanley. I followed her at conferences, read her book. Eventually got to guest blog on Marketing Profs. Same with Michael Brenner. Like, it's building those relationships and passing the knowledge on. But again, it's you have to push yourself. You have to stay sharp. If you go in, if you phone it in, if you're low and slow, collect the dough, you're going to be out the door very quickly.
That's really going to resonate with a lot of listeners, because I don't think there's a whole lot of people listening to this who tend to phone it in anyway. So, Jason, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I would say this. It's never too late to reinvent yourself.
Yes.
Again and again and again. I've sort of had to reinvent myself 3 or 4 times. It's not easy. If it were easy, everyone would be doing it. But you can do it. It is achievable. And I think it's a great experience. And when you come out on the other end and you said, I did it, you won't be doing it by yourself, because you're going to need some help, but it's a good feeling, and it keeps you moving forward. And I think, you know, you sometimes you just need that to do it for yourself, to make yourself happy and keep yourself content. But it's reinvention. Find something you're passionate about, find something you want to learn, and go master it.
And you know what? It's okay if you don't know what you're doing. I mean, look at me. I'm almost 500 episodes into this thing. I'm still trying to figure it out. But dear listener, I do appreciate you listening. So what is one thing a listener could do today just to put in action an idea from your book to get them sort of thinking in the right direction?
Easy, very easy. When you wake up in the morning, write down what's in your mind. Do a brain dump. I used to be a sort of a night owl, and now that I'm getting older, It happens in the morning, and I think it's because of the kids, obviously. But any idea you have in your head, you have to put it down in paper, in Google. I have 700 ideas over the past year and a half in Google Docs. Get the ideas out of your head. Every time you see something in the wild, write it down and keep these organized, because these ideas are what is going to keep you moving forward. They're going to keep your momentum and your learning and your curiosity is going to be born from these. So pick the best ideas, flush them out. I think that's the biggest thing. So everyone has something to say, a story, something to contribute, a big idea. It's just, how do you put it into a place where you can keep tabs on it, add to it, and run with it and release it into the wild? That's, I think, the biggest thing anyone can do.
And I'll add, there is so much science behind what you just advised. The idea of writing down, journaling, really, really powerful. Some of the most successful people do that. So aside from your three books that you mentioned, are there any recent or upcoming books you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
So, as I mentioned in the book, J.J. French from Twisted Sister wrote a really great book called Twisted Business, which is where I borrowed the bizwire from.
Oh, okay.
I think it's just a really great book on what J.J. was a manager of Twisted Sister. You know, he still manages all their deals and whatnot. But he ties in these personal stories, and I think that's what I'm really into. I'm really into biographies right now and learning from others, and that's kind of my thing. It's the personal stories tied in with the business lessons, and I think that's the future of where a lot of these cool books are heading, in my opinion.
I wouldn't be surprised, because your book was so much fun to read.
It was meant to be like a movie. Like you can get through it in 2 hours and hopefully one or two sittings. And there's also this theme of these short stories, like these different anecdotes pulled together, right. Which I really like that theme as well. So
yeah, it would make a great screenplay or a Netflix series. But I should warn you, I'm full of ideas as long as I don't have to implement them. Hey, real quick, tell us about rockandrollcocktail.com.
Rockandrollcocktail.com is it's the website. It's the blog I started, over 10 years ago when I just started getting my ideas out there. It's still going. It's still a place where I just put my thoughts and music that I love, music I think you should hear, thoughts on creativity, photography lessons, everything I learn. I document and I put it out there, and that's what I've done from day one of the transition, from music industry into B2B. So, that's me. That's everything. It's my narrative. It's flowing in one direction and it's updated. And, it's a visual, fun approach for me to have that outlet. So I don't wait for anybody to tell my story. I do it myself.
Oh, that's great. And I appreciate you doing that. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books and articles you've mentioned, that site, your LinkedIn profile. And now a word to you, dear listener, please reach out to Jason in some way and congratulate him on this book and thank him for being a guest again on the Marketing Book Podcast. If nothing else, share this interview on LinkedIn and tag us so we can thank you. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Couple of final quotes. I just can't resist. Page 91. My seemingly inexhaustible creativity has always guided me. What fuels it? An unrelenting appetite for inspiration and learning. Surrounding myself with folks who navigate the marketing maze better than I can and being open to new approaches. The growth mindset isn't just a fancy phrase. And from page 105, if I had to sum up my life, I'd say that it's a story that wasn't supposed to happen, but it did. A teen metalhead's dream of rock stardom becoming music marketing, becoming digital marketing, becoming public speaking and publishing, becoming concert photography, becoming. The iterations of self should only end when you're pushing daisies. If you cannot keep shedding your skin, you risk being a waste of skin. The book is Second Skin, Tales and Truths from the Mosh Pit of Life. The author is Jason Miller. Jason, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
I am so thrilled that you invited me back. I'm a big fan. You know that. Thank you for everything. What a great conversation.
Well, and to paraphrase John Lennon, I hope I pass the audition and that you'll return.
1,000% anytime, say the word.
Can you dig it!
It's time to get down to business with $30 a month business internet. WOW Business offers 99.9% network reliability so that you can keep your business moving. $30 a month gets you 30 megabytes per second with 24/7 US-based support, a price lock guarantee, and a 60-day satisfaction guarantee. Lock in our lowest priced offer for the support you need. Go to switchtowellbusiness.com. Offer for new customers with a 2-year agreement subject to change. Prices do not include taxes, fees, and equipment charges. Restrictions apply.